for my group at Bamboo in the Wind, we're in our fourth year of doing, we're practicing with much more focus, mindfulness for the month of August. So in keeping with that spirit, I just thought I'd let it overflow over here into Jagoti. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about, I don't know if any of you have heard of the Surangama Sutra. It's a Mahayana Sutra that's, it has some Yogacara in it, so I think it's about the 4th century or so, something like that. And in it, there's an exchange or a dialogue that Buddha has with Ananda. You probably know Ananda really was highly skilled in taking in all of the Buddha's words, in the sense that he could then basically parrot them back to anybody. He had this skill where he could repeat the oral teachings without a flaw. But as a result, Ananda often, we could say, got caught in hearing the words and, missing the meaning. So there's a dialogue now in the Surangama Sutra between Buddha and Ananda. And it has to do with Buddha questioning Ananda. What does he see when, he holds up his golden arm and fist? And Ananda says, well, it's your, arm, your golden arm and fist. And Buddha says, no, Ananda, no. No, it's your false thinking. This is not, seen. And instead, this false thinking is arising from external objects. And you're confusing it. You're mixing it in with your true mind. So there's a continuation of different objects and about the same kind of level of dialogue. What is it? And Buddha keeps questioning him, and he's turned upside down, and he's very frustrated. He says, come, Buddha, feel compassion towards me. Give me a clue. So this does go on for some time, but basically Buddha is pointing out that what it is it's his attachment to clinging of self, the ego, and that's one of the issues. That's considered more of a gross level attachment, but there's also subtle attachment to ego, which is more of the inborn. So some of this with Yogacara has to do with the sixth consciousness and then the seventh consciousness. So the sixth consciousness is mind, and the seventh is, of course, the aspect of mind that has to do with fantasy or, discrimination, those kinds of things. So I thought today, since we all know how Ananda struggled, maybe we can try something to ourselves, see how we do. Since discriminating mind is some of the root of our suffering. There is a koan in the Book of Serenity called the Surangama's Not Seen. So I'm going to pass out some of the this is just some of the koan. It has the title, of course, you can see the introduction and the case. But there's actually much more to the koan. There's a commentary on the case, and then there's a verse that's written by Tian Tang Hongzhi. And then there's also an additional commentary on the verse, and then additional sayings on whatever Zen masters wanted to comment on. But for our purposes today, I would like to have this more of a exchange, and you know, have you join in and share your thoughts about what's going on in this koan, because you know, koans are really all about us anyway. They're about they're public cases we can apply to our life, and it's just that we don't know how to unlock the koan. And if you understand certain aspects about koans, of how they're structured, for example, some of the structural patterns like repetition or parallelism, or that the fact that there's layered teachings, and you know, then it makes it much more accessible. When you look at the metaphors that might be present in the koan. And thinking it from, of course, the conventional way, which is where we are, but then also then moving it into a universal or ultimate way of looking at the material, and then taking the next step of saying, well, how does this affect me? How does it apply to me? Because we all know. We don't see. We all know that. We see, but we don't see. And we learn by what we don't see. So let's see what the Surangama's not seeing is about. So I, first of all, the title, which you know now is referencing this sutra. Ananda didn't see something, right? He had not seen. So that the title is very important, because it usually tells us, you know, something about what's going to be in the koan. Whereas the introduction is really more of summarizing the koan and then saying, you know, getting into what's important in the koan. So most times when we think of koans, you probably think of these little pithy cases, you know. But in the Book of Serenity, which is really material from the Soto school, there's much more material that is around a koan. So the introduction is actually, if you study the introductions, you can get really a much better sense about what's going on in the case. And then after you've done those two, you can work backwards. But we're not going to go into the whole koan. I don't think we have enough time. We need much longer time to do the whole koan. Okay, so who would like to read the introduction? Not me. Not me. Come on, who wants to do it? Lance.
All right. Well, I didn't say I wanted to, but I was looking at you.
I guess that's an indicator.
Okay. When there is seeing, when there is seeing and there is not seeing, this is lighting a lamp at midday. When there is no seeing and no not seeing, this is pouring ink at midnight. If you believe seeing and hearing are like illusion creating cataracts, then you will know that sound and form are like flowers in the sky. But tell me, in the teachings, is there talk of patch-robed monks?
So when they're seeing and there is not seeing, what kind of seeing is that? Anybody have any ideas about seeing and not seeing when he's using that phrase?
Selective seeing,
mm-hmm.
That we choose to look at what we like to look at, maybe, or what we avoid what we don't like to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. So how is that kind of seeing and not seeing, like lighting a lamp at midday? Any ideas on that?
Because it's duality, and it's
mm-hmm.
It's nonsensical. You don't light a lamp at midday.
Right. No, that's one way, yes. Right, it's adding something to it, right? We think. So we could say if when you think about seeing and not seeing, what happens when we actually add stuff on top of what we're seeing? What are we doing? We're actually applying attributes. We're imputing, we're embellishing, we're somehow fabricating reality more than what it is, right? We're putting all kinds of stuff on it. So if we would say, you know, this bell is bell, right? We named it, so there's a label issue. You know, it's already moved away from what it is. So step away. But we could say, well, you know, the bell sounds, you know, that it has a beautiful quality. Or it may sound like it's flat. So we these are attributes that we would be applying to the bell. But how much more do we apply to ourselves and to our experiences, to our perceptions? That's what we're getting at here. We're really looking at our own internal activity about what we project out in the world, how we discriminate, in what ways, how we place value judgments on our experience. And as a result, when we do all those things, you can cause suffering for yourself and others because you have strong opinions about something, you have preferences, you have that may get in the way. I'm not saying any of this has negative consequences to the point that you know you can't do that, but you must be aware of what you're doing. And this is the part about seeing and not seeing. So if you are expressing a preference, are you aware you're expressing a preference? That's the point. So that your preference doesn't get mixed up in what reality really is. Because it's that projection of that preference which is what's the potential for suffering. Certainly when we get things mixed up, we actually believe our preferences are reality. I mean, just read the newspapers. Listen to the radio. We know people have pretty strong opinions about reality. So, lighting the lamp at midday is one way to consider seeing and not seeing of how we're adding in more stuff.
How does one move from having one feeling very quickly into having another feeling, having multiple feelings over what's going on? Am I making myself clear?
So it sounds like it just moved, the experience is like concatenated into different feelings, is
yes.
That right? So are you aware of your feelings as you're moving through, maybe from frustration, anger, to hostility, you know, to resentment, to, you know, these are all feelings.
Yes.
So, this is part of the wheel of life and death in terms of even just the nugget of feeling of how we do go through this spinning, so to speak. So there is a way you can stop, and it is, there are different practices that you could employ, and one of them might be that you would just stop and take a breath and bring awareness to your breath. That might be one way to see if you can disengage from the especially if the feeling is very intense and it's moving very quickly. And go within yourself instead of without you know, outside of yourself in the external world where you might be, that might be the trigger for those feelings. So if you can withdraw inward and then, like, find your center, you know, do like a mini zazen for a little bit, see if you can settle in to yourself. So there are other practices. Some people might go into a mantra instead of, you know, the practice of, and use that as a stopping technique. We had a mantra in today's chant, Gate Gate Paragate, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone to the other shore. Hooray. Hallelujah. So try some of those kinds of practices that they might help you. But whatever is going on, you want to stop so you can become present. That's the key. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So when there's no seeing and no not seeing, this is pouring ink at midnight. No seeing. We had a lot of no's in the Heart Sutra today. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no no seeing. Okay, no seeing and no not seeing. How does that? What do you think? No? Any ideas? No seeing, no not seeing.
To me, you know, when I'm practicing, I'm aware, you know, there's kind of, there's a lot going on, obviously, but there's noticing the sensations of the body, and there's also opening to peripheral, and just noticing the sounds and stuff like that. So when I hear that, and even when I hear pouring ink at midnight, to me it sounds beautiful, you know, and it sounds like this kind of seamlessness of, you know, there being no separation. So no seeing, no not seeing feels like that place of where the attention is both here and here, and there's no within and no without.
Mm-hmm. So then pouring ink on at midnight is then for you. What image does it present to you? Any?
Well, I see the actual pouring of ink at midnight when obviously nothing shows up.
Okay.
Well, that's what I see.
Yeah.
Black.
Well, right. Nothing shows up. Right. It's black. Right.
And then that nothingness that happens in practice when.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Right. Any other thoughts? Not seeing. Because remember in Buddhism, when you start seeing the use of no, you're really moving into the universal. You know, and so no seeing, you're moving out of the just phenomena. You know, we're now leaping beyond that. And so it just like in the Heart Sutra, when you talk about no eyes, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, this is very similar. This is like no seeing and no not seeing.
So the two metaphors, the lighting the lamp at midnight and pouring the ink at midnight. Just thinking that they're basically kind of saying that nothing happens. There's activity, or there's expressions, or there's actions, but these actions don't have any. You can't distinguish them from the environment, or you can't distinguish them from non-activity. So they're actually something happens, but also sort of nothing happens in the sense that it's lighting the lamp at in the middle of the day, then there's no the lamp doesn't express itself, right? Mm-hmm. The lamp's of no use.
Mm-hmm.
And pouring ink at night, where you can't see the ink, you know, mm-hmm. the ink is not making a mark because mm-hmm. it's no visible mark, mm-hmm. right? So I'm curious how this how these two expressions, how that works in the context of.
So maybe it's also adding to the principle. I think that's I've not heard that before. It's, but it could be, you know, because it's this layered teachings that I'm thinking about, no coming, no going. You know, it just is, right? There's, if reality is as it is, then there is no coming and going. Just like there is no lighting. I mean, the lighting of the lamp at midday is like nothing happening.
Like the song of the Jewelmere Samadhi, hiding a heron in the moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two white things, and when they're together, you can't tell what they are.
Mm-hmm.
That he's talking about thusness or as it isness.
Yes.
Yeah. Or mm-hmm. what's the other one? Hiding a heron. Hiding a heron. It's
like filling a hole with
silver
bowl.
A silver bowl
with
snow. Right.
And there's something about it's bright just at midnight. Or even though, no.
And oh, in the light of dawn, it is hidden.
It seems parallel to this.
Pardon?
Makes it bright at midnight, but don't be attached to this brightness.
Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. They're taken as similar, they're not the same. When you align them, you know what they are.
I think, Lance, you're thinking of one from Sandokan.
Oh, different
sutra. Well, Sandokan says, in the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the light, in the dark there is light, but don't see it as light.
Then later on it says, though appearing bright at midnight, it will not be noticed as dawn. That's kind of a parallel to that metaphor, isn't it?
So these are layered teachings. So by the time koans came out, Hongzhi is the person who wrote the verse. So, at least in this form, they were written before and lost, and you know now they were in this form. So Hongzhi is like I think maybe 100 years before Dogen. So we had Hongzhi, then Tian Tang Rujing, and then Dogen.
Yeah.
So,
Hongzhi?
Hongzhi, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hongzhi. Mm-hmm. Mix up Chinese pronunciation. Yeah. Yes, he's the one who wrote all the verses for us. Yes. So you can see, even just in how far did we get? We have just a few lines in there. We've already seen how many teachings have already come through. Yes, Lance.
Yeah, one more comment about it. Pretty similar to what we said. I took the lighting the lamp at midday, seeing and not seeing. When you see something, like you talk about the value,
mm-hmm.
to make it a thing, mm-hmm. you also throw your conceptualization upon mm-hmm. it. You point it out in space, and then, mm-hmm. and then almost immediately,
mm-hmm.
there's a conceptualization attached to this yes. process in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there, that's the lamp at midday. It's not revealing. To light a lamp at midday doesn't reveal anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of took it as kind of a, you have to get beyond the conceptualization
yes.
process to see
mm-hmm.
things as they really are. That's what when the Buddha held up his hands and said, let's just go. No, that's not what it is.
Right.
And then the ink at midnight, interesting. I don't think it's quite the same as lighting the lamp. I think of that more as like there's shades of black, that there's a richness to it, that within this midnight, you can go deeper and deeper by pouring ink. So it's like a never-ending midnight. But maybe that's not your intention whatsoever.
I think at this point we have to suspend that kind of thinking, because every word means something here, and I think how it resonates with you is more important. There's no book on koans that has the answers, so we can let that one go. So what, you know, seeing it as you have, I think, is as valid as any other comment. And it's because for you, it meant, well, this is what it's like, going deeper and deeper, pouring ink. And so the image will resonate with you and stay beyond this moment, and maybe help you somehow in your practice. So we don't know. We just don't know. I think with both lighting and pouring, what I like about those words is that they're moving. There's activity. They're not fixed, and that's another part of koan study. Is just like life, everything is always constantly moving. Everything is impermanent and subject to change. And if we would say, well, lit the lamp and poured something, that those are like, they kind of came and went, but it isn't the same as saying something is happening right now, pouring and lighting, which then seems to get beyond the fact that this was written back in maybe, 11th or 12th century, so which is different than what we might normally consider as something so ancient to still apply today in this way. So it seems like it's been, I mean, what we see and don't see happen right here, right?
What does pouring ink refer to in that cultural context? Does it refer to act of writing or painting or making ink? Is there a practice of some sort of a craft like practice there?
Calligraphy, right. It would use ink, right? Sumiang, I suppose, would also, or Chinese painting would use ink.
So that would kind of apply. No conceptualization is going to occur if you're pouring ink in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm gonna write anything.
Right. You won't see what you're writing. You won't see. So we have a little time yet, but what are we at? So let me see. Maybe we should move on to the next line here. If you believe seeing and hearing are like illusion creating cataracts. What is that image? Look. How are seeing and hearing, how can they be like illusion creating cataracts?
You create a story from what you hear and what you see, and that story can be like a painting, a waterfall that's falling, and I think cataract is a waterfall, but
I understood cataract as being sort of a prism in your eye, so a distortion in your hearing and seeing. I don't know if that's the correct interpretation. So what you see and what you hear are distortions of what is to be seen and heard.
I'm thinking of it more along the lines of you hear some sound, you hear some sound, you see something, and based on that sensory stimulus, you create a story of what is happening. And that story is like a painting that you mm-hmm. create. It's an artificial...
Mm-hmm.
It's something that you create based on what the stimulus mm-hmm. or sensory stimulus that you've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, so this, when it says sound and form are like flowers in the sky, that's again an illusion
mm-hmm.
linked to the act of illusion. So thinking is an active process of illusion making or story making
mm-hmm.
based on whatever stimulus we hear. You mm-hmm. hear a gunshot, you make up the story based on that.
Mm-hmm. So the I think that it's whether you're fabricating the story or you're through your thoughts of you're actually distorting reality. It's similar idea. I was thinking of cataracts also coverings over your eyes, so you don't really get to see clearly. If you're saying through the prism, things get very distorted. So that before you know it, you have flowers in the sky. I'm just leaping right out there. So maybe we can still go through the last sentence. We have 12:30, is that the... plan.
We can keep going. Finish as you want.
Okay. So, any other thoughts about flowers in the sky? Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was kind of puzzled by this because it sounds like they're actually attacking seeing and hearing, the basic seeing and hearing perceptual process, not
mm-hmm.
the overlay. But they're not making a distinction between the two.
Mm.
But maybe even then, I thought even the seeing and hearing, maybe they're saying we're like limited, kind of like Dogen says. We see lakes as jewels if you look at them,
mm-hmm.
but to a fish it's a glass palace. So we're all our what we take as the world is our own creation, even at the most fundamental level of our seeing.
Mm-hmm.
We're limited by our senses.
Mm-hmm.
We're all just creating our own world through our sensory apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they don't talk that way quite, but so we could also make flowers in the sky, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this idea of if we circle back to the first line about when there is seen and there is not seen, I think in the actual Suragama Sutra they talk about seeing in that use of the true mind, enlightened mind, and how the enlightened mind sees. Bill, what you were asking about how do you extricate yourself, with this intensity of the feelings? How do you just feel without, all of the story making that goes along with it? It's this experience of being present with what is, as it is. And, without the object of not seeing, that's the distortion out there on the object of what we've, projected it as. So there's another way you can also view or see or experience this kind of koan is to take it from the experience of as it is, experiencing reality as it is, and how difficult that, of course, is to actually see. Most of the time, we're not seeing. It's clouded by... our own fabrications or delusion. So, I think our author here is actually encouraging us because, in the last sentence he's saying, but tell me, are the teachings, in the teachings is there talk of patch-robed monks? And so this one I had to look up. Sometimes you get some clues from Cleary, Thomas Cleary, who's translated this text. And he refers to talk of Patrobe monks as the living meaning of Zen. So, is there talk of Patrobe in the teaching? So, yes.
Yeah, I read that last sentence as like, how does it apply to everyday life? Like, and that's, it's monks talking to monks, so it's kind of like saying, well, what is, how's that for you? How's that going for you?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How can you use it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So how can we use this kind of teaching of not seeing and seeing? I think then because, you know, mindful, we could try to see our not seeing. That's the first step, is to see what we don't see. Whether it's in our perceptions or in our feelings or whether it's in our ideas, you know, not only beliefs, but also thoughts about who we are, who we think we are, and then all of our attachments. So I think this, we have a chance to do some practicing with this. And one good question to ask yourself is, what am I not seeing? Because in not seeing is where you will see. So you can play with these, this koan to whatever level you can. Because
in the case itself,
yes?
do you have some...
Some thoughts, should we just read the case and have some thoughts?
You could speak to the case before we end.
Who would like to read it? Cliff?
The Surangama scripture says, if I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? If you see my not seeing, that is naturally not the characteristic of not seeing. If you don't see my not seeing, it's naturally not a thing. How could it not be you?
You want to diagram those sentences? So actually this is somewhat of the flip side, because now from the introduction, because now we're in a lot of the no knots and what we don't see and may not, you know, may not see, might not see. So we can look at it from a different perspective now. And the question that I would ask is, what dharma position are you in here when you're when you don't see? Why don't you see my not seeing?
Who's the you that it's referring to? Is, why don't you, the person, see the scriptures non-seeing?
No, you is in maybe in if I, you can ask me it, and say, well, or I would ask you, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing?
It belongs only to you.
All right. So my at one level, my experience based on causes and conditions of my life, just as you, so you're not going to see what I see, right? We all know about, well, eyewitnesses reporting on an accident, how different their views are, what they see and don't see. But what about the scene? Let's see. Why, if you see my not seeing, that is naturally not the characteristic of not seeing. So we are shifting now, you know, so this is typical of koans, you move from one position to the next. So you're in maybe talking about everyday life, and then you're flipping into the universal, then you're flipping back into everyday life. So we could say, when we say it's not a thing, how could it not be you? So in the universal, we don't discriminate. There's no discrimination. and in no discrimination, that is...
You are available to be you.
That's right.
Truly you.
Truly you. And so is everyone else. And everyone else has that that potential. That everyone else has that Buddha nature. Right? So that's the thing that they don't have. No, it's not a thing. It's not a thing. Let's leave it at that.
It seems like that first sentence, when you don't see the question, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? I was thinking about that, that in a certain sense, like we, in everyday activity, we're sort of, we sort of create this delusion field around us with our conceptual mind, and particularly our thoughts about ourselves, and making the world our agenda, the agenda of own being, and we co-opt other people to support and sustain that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we say, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? Well, it's because we've co-opted everyone around us, that we've made allies of our self-deceivers to sustain ourselves. So, that kind of makes sense. I mean, in the context of that first sentence, why don't you? Well, of course, I don't see your not seeing because I'm part of your not seeing. I'm part of the conspiracy of making you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you, your idea of you, you. So, if you don't see my not seeing, that is naturally the characteristic of not seeing.
No, that is naturally not
the characteristic of not seeing. Yeah. It's this really works actually. Yeah.
Mm. So we all get to see a little today, just a little.
But if on the other hand, if you don't see my not seeing. In other words, if I don't feed you, your delusion of you, if I'm not a co-conspirator in the own being of you, or the separation of you from reality, then it's not a thing. It's not an object outside of yourself. So how could it not be you? How could you not be you then?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it's kind of saying.
Mm-hmm.
If that drops off, then you're available to be.
Good.
This is good.
Very rich reading.
Yes.
That's
yes.
A very rich interpretation.
Yeah.
That's a very nice interpretation.
Yes. All right. If we can thank you so much for seeing.